This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org. C.D. Wright with Stephen Burt, recorded in Santa Fe on April 19, 2006. The poet C.D. Wright can be described as an experimental writer, a Southern writer, and a socially committed writer whose work is rooted in the landscape and people of her childhood in the Ozark Mountains of Arkansas. After reading from her work, Miss Wright joins in conversation with poet, essayist, and literary critic Stephen Burt.
Good evening and welcome to the Lannan Readings and Conversation series. I'm Steve Burt. I'm here from St. Paul, Minnesota. And thank you so much for coming. Thank you so much for bringing us. C.D. Wright is one of the most aesthetically powerful and original American poets now at work. She is also one of the most various from work to work and book to book, one of the most heartfelt from voice to voice, and one of the most fun to read. She began as a compelling creator of post-surrealist scenes, jazz-suffused elegies, lyric sketches of dreamlands gone badly wrong. She moved in Further Adventures with You into poems as scenes with props, characters, even lights, poems imagined or reimagined as films, poems as reports on real or imagined travel from Mexico to the Faroe Islands. Just Whistle was the first of her genre melding or genre busting, completely compelling non-narrative book-length works. There have since been more. Just Whistle established C.D. Wright as a poet of the body, of the sexy body, the endangered body, the body giving birth, the body as felt or as seen in photography. Stringlight, with its endlessly quotable, fabulously compact Ozark odes, its versions of poet as mother, as prophet, as goat, really, as goat, was the first book, I think, to show her at her full range, from its lapidary verse invitations to its porch sprawl prose. Tremble is her most lyrical book, the one through which many of us discovered her talents. It was the book that told us that everything good between men and women has been written in mud and butter and barbecue sauce. That Warren don't go boring your nose in the fork of a tree not even present. And promised, I came to talk you into physical splendor. I do not wish to speak to your machine. She knows, she has shown us how to re-regard, how to reimagine fragments as wholes, how to reframe pieces of language spoken by her or by someone else, how to look, what to do, what to see, and when to stop. And she has pursued most recently a range of spectacular series and book-length projects. Retablos, about which we'll hear more, I think, later. Deep Step Comes Shining with its road trip insights and its Orphic vision. One Big Self, Prisoners of Louisiana, with its ethical and documentary demands on us and on the country whose prisoners it records. C.D. Wright is a poet who never repeats herself, who has remained faithful to the particular language and place where she grew up and to the wider demands and glories of the English and American language, which she knows is out there for all of us. Few poets have done so much with it or used so much of it so well. Please welcome C.D. Wright.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Steve Burt, one of a kind Steve Burt. And thank you, Patrick Lannan, and the foundation, and the wonderful staff of the Lannan Foundation. And I'm really, really happy to be here. We love Santa Fe. We're staying. we're ready to look at real estate. All we need are jobs. Re-happiness in pursuit thereof. It is 2005, just before landfall. Here I am, a maze, and I am a mess. I am located at the corner of Waterway and Bluff. I need your help. You will find me to the left of the graveyard, where the trees grow especially talkative at night, where fog and alcohol rub off the edge. We burn to make one another sing, to make the lake not boil, the earth not rock. We are running on Aztec time now, fifth and final cycle. Eyes switch on, off. We would be mercurochrome to one another, bee balm or chamomile. We should be concrete, glass, and spandex. We should be digital, or at least early. Be ivory billed, invisible, except to the most prepared observer. We will be stardust, a light blue gas. No, we must first be ice, be nails, be teeth, be lightning. Elation washed over our absence toward everything in the increasing darkness. The soft coloration of his longing in the indifferent environment has never deserted me. My husband saving the spermaceti to light our eye strings. My husband charting my obsessions with characteristic cool. Singing sacerdotally in the shower, my husband intoning every cleft in my skin, our syncopated breathing, my husband, who flew often at night as a child, above the very ground of our riding, even as power poles were falling on Volvos. My husband, equally popular with women of all ages, his nail parings, his running legs, his scriptoria, oh, his ludic hard head. Who cut down his own hair with a bone-handled knife, his rack of gorgeous, unworn ties, my husband touching even the insular men. Whenever fear bred its mushrooms under rugs, a cleaning frenzy commenced. Our bed irrigated with my blood, watching me burn from within, tendering his crosspin, oh, predominantly white gilt. Whenever it rained, elation washed over our absence toward everything in the increasing darkness. In our only time. Follow me, the voice, the long, longed-for voice stops the riding hand. I have your shoes. Except for a rotating fan, movement at a minimum. The plan, if one can call it a plan, is to be in what is known to some as the perennial present, beginning with a few sentences written in the kitchen while others cling to their own images in twisted sheets of heat. A napkin floats from a counter in lieu of a letter. Portals of the backlife part in silence. O verge of song, O big islets of daylight, leaving milk and bowl on the table, leaving the house discalced. All this mystery mildly erotic, even if one is terrified of both death and the color red. Even if a message is sent each of us in secrecy, no one can make it stay. Notwithstanding scale, everything has its meaning, everything matters. No one a means, everyone an end, in our only time. Provinces. Where the old trees reign with their forward dark, light stares through a hole in the body's long house, the bed rolls away from the body, and the body is forced to find a chair. At some hour, the body sequesters itself in a shuttered room with no clock. When a clean sheet of paper floats by, the head inclines on its axis. It is one of those common bodies that felt it could not exist without loving, but has in fact gone on and on without love. Like a cave that has stopped growing, we don't call it dead, but dormant. Now the body is on all fours, one arm engaged in pulling hair from a trap, an activity the body loathes. When the time comes, the body feeds on marinated meats and fruits trained to be luscious. Once the body had ambitions to be tall and remain soft, no more, but it enjoys repelling to the water. Because the body's dwelling is stone perched over water, we say the body is privileged. Akin to characters in Lawrence books, its livelihood is obscured. It owns a horse named Campaign. It mounts on foggy morns. That was the body's first lie. It has no horse and wouldn't climb on one. Because the body lives so far from others, it likes reading about checkered lives in the metropoli. It likes moving around at night under its dress. When it travels, bottles of lotion open in its bags. Early in March, the big rains came, washing all good thoughts from the body's cracks and chinks. By now, the body admits it is getting on and yet continues to be tormented by things being the way they are. Recently, the body took one of the old trees for a wife, but the union has broken down. The light has bored out of the body's long house. Fog envelops its stone flanks. Still, the body enjoys repelling to the water, and it likes the 24-hour stores, walking up and down the aisles, not putting a thing in its basket. Petition for replenishment. We do not mean to complain. We know how it is. In older, even sadder cultures, the worst possible sorts have been playing hot and cold with people's lives for much longer. Like Perrault says, we'll all have baboon hearts one of these days. We wintered with ample fuel and real tomatoes. We were allowed to roam, sniffing and chewing at the tufted crust. We were let to breathe, that is, we respirated. Now the soft clocks have gorged themselves on our time. Yet as our hair blanches and comes out in hanks, we can tell it is nearly spring. The students shed their black coats on the green. We begin to see shade. Lo, this is the breastbone's embraceable light. We are here, still breathing and constellated. I'm going to read an excerpt from a longer poem called Rising, Falling, Hovering. It's a poem about the war, the current war. And it's also a poem about personal life, and it also has to do with my relationship with Mexico. I don't know if any of that, well, at least the war part will be evident from this part. So from Rising, Falling, Hovering. In front of a donut shop, someone's son is shot dead. A witness on condition of anonymity, the slow, open, vulgar mouth drawing on a cigarette, in a face once called forever young, now to be known as never a man. Gone to the world of the working and the prevaricating, of the warring, world of drywalling, of lousy test scores, of fishing from a bridge on a brilliant afternoon, belt buckle blown undone. Recollect reading to her boy, reading to him in bed, overcome herself with sleep as if drugged or slugged, then jabbed up again. Come on, keep reading, don't stop, don't ever stop. Like she was saying, beauty cannot, she cannot marry the beast. And tonight, as on all other rose-scented evens, he stumbles, the beast, he stumbles from beauty's empty chamber. In agony, he goes in agony, the fur of his fingers smoking, until it's her boy. He is the one saying, exclaiming, yes, yes, he will marry the beast. Until he is the one who conks out as a light pole struck by a drunken car, and suddenly it's raining like plastic. When she stumbles at last from the room, he is the one who shakes himself awake and yells, protect me, and she is the one who promises, exclaiming, yes, yes, she will. I swear, if it kills me, I will. As once the mother of forever young shot in front of the donut shop must have sworn, if it killed her, she will. A boy so quiet, the reporter heard from his kin, you wouldn't even notice him on your electric bill. Over there, it's a different world, desperate to be rejoined to this one. It is still raining like plastic, the brazen daytime rave of cicada cut off in a fast fade to black, a low intensity shattering within. To dramatize the break, her confidential informant is her imagination. Request for him not to be photographed in this position, not the flash of flesh, the powder burns that pepper the chest. You won't believe what I was dreaming. To the flash of flesh, the scarred back. Do not think him healed. Go back to sleep. It never happened. There was a cenote and steps dug out of the centuries and dogs, always dogs. The hot iron on her chest, she feels it now. It is her familiar, the fear, the sear. She is driving, or is she being driven? Trees and fences fall behind. An oil truck changes lanes without warning. The water on her right looks dead. Bird sanctuary, void of birdsong. She forgets where she is headed, a meeting, no, an errand, an appointment. Is her life comic or tragic? That card stays face down. She doesn't even know what hand she's playing or whose house belongs to the white rhododendron. Across the river is a whole other world, hotel once grand with a ballroom called Starlight, a lobby that smells like assisted living dinner. Smoke-discolored chandelier, aloe vera and bromeliad felted with dust, and toenails of the truly old painted for twirling across polished floors. And one of the old ones in a camphoric gown says she wore this when she was smaller. Spotlights on the fountain tinted for travelers in the time of terror, color of the koi. Wasted figure in a tall mirror, clad in ratty rags, forewarns, these are the last hours of empire, or some such inauspicious whispering. So what? So can I have a cigarette? In the absence of any foreseeable remedy. She ran off with a fallen aristocrat, an adventurer cut down on his burrow by banditos, belt-blown, undone, wrecked down there. When she came back to U.S., they sent her son to Baghdad, whom she vowed to protect. If it kills her, she will. There's not a troy ounce of compassion in this scenario. There is the inhuman dimension, the bridges breaking off in chunks of gray, libraries folding, school buildings indistinguishable from penitentiaries. Like I said to the doorman the other night, some moon, huh? You should have seen it before the war, miss. We must not get used to this. To be continued. A love poem, but you would have known that, so I take back that I said that. You would certainly know that. Floating trees. A bed is left open to a mirror. A mirror gazes long and hard at a bed. Light fingers the house with its own acoustics. One of them writes this down. One has paper. bed of swollen creeks and theories and coils, bed of eyes and leaky pens. Much of the night, the air touches arms. Arms extend themselves to air, their torsos turning toward a roll of sound, thunder. Night of coonscat and vandalized headstones, night of deep kisses and catamania. His face by this light, saurian, hers ash like the tissue of a hornet's nest. One scans the aisle of firs, the faint blue line of them. One looks out, sans serif. Didn't I hear you tell them you were born on a train? What begins with a suff and ends with a groan in which the tongue's true color is revealed. The comb suff and the denim's undeniable rub, the chair stripped back and muddied rung, color of stone soup and garden gloves, color of meal and treacle and sphagnum. Hangers clinging to their coat, a soft white bulb to its string. The footprints inside us iterate the footprints outside. The scratched words return to their sleeves. The dresses of Monday through Friday swallow the long hips of weekends. A face is studied like a key for the mystery of what it once opened. I didn't mean to wake you, angel brains. Ink of eyes and veins and phonemes, the ink completes the feeling. A mirror silently facing a door with no lock. The room he brings into you, the room befalls you. Like the fir trees, he trues her, she nears him, like the firs. If one vanishes, one stays. If one stays, the other will or will not vanish. Otherwise, my beautiful green fly, otherwise not a leaf stirs. This is from a series of girlfriend poems. They are friendship poems. Girlfriend. When I first saw her a few summers ago, I felt her photogenic spit. I was climbing a coruscating staircase in my flammable skin. To be so full of everything at her age, it is very difficult. A singer, manque, among a small host of poets, noisier than the men, quaffing schnapps. No lens could describe her. Shoulders, hands, such longings, errant, verdant, to have a good time and dream in one's own country. The lack of everything, the confusion, it is very difficult. One needs one's own set of golden books. What if a ladder were miraculous, extended across a nursery for new stars, and then. Song of the Gourd. In gardening, I continued to sit on my side of the car, to drive whenever possible at the usual level of distraction. In gardening, I shat nails, glass, contaminated dirt, and threw up on the new shoots. In gardening, I learned to praise things I had dreaded. I pushed the hair out of my face. I felt less responsible for one man's death, one woman's long-term isolation. My bones softened. In gardening, I lost nickels and ring settings. I uncovered buttons and marbles. I laid half the worm aside and sought the rest. I sought myself in the bucket and wondered why I came into being in the first place. In gardening, I turned away from the television and went around smelling of offal, the inedible parts of the chicken. In gardening, I said, excelsior. In gardening, I required no company. I had to forgive my own failure to perceive how things were. I went out bare-legged at dusk and dug and dug and dug. I hit rock. My ovaries softened. In gardening, I was protean, as in no other realm before or since. I longed to torch my old belongings and belch a little flame of satisfaction. In gardening, I longed to stroll farther into soundlessness. I could almost forget what happened many swift years ago in Arkansas. I felt like a god from down under, Thonian. In gardening, I thought, this is it, body and soul, I am home at last. Excelsior, praise the grass. In gardening, I fled the fold that supported the war. Only in gardening could I stop shrieking, stop, stop the slaughter. Only in gardening could I press my ear to the ground to hear my soul let out an unyielding noise. My line softened. I turned the water onto the joy-filled boy child. Only in gardening did I feel fit to partake, to go on trembling in the last light. I confess the abject urge to weed your beds while the bittersweet overwhelmed my daylilies. I summoned the courage to grin. I climbed the hill with my bucket and slept like a dipper in the cool of your body, besotted with growth, shot through by green. This is a love poem. You'll know that. I never understand when people get up and explain their poems when they're self-evident, so I've tried not to be the village explainer. Lake Echo, dear. Is the woman in the pool of light really reading or just staring at what is written? Is the man walking in the soft rain naked, or is it the rain that makes his shirt transparent? The boy in the iron cot, is he asleep or still fingering the springs underneath? Did you honestly believe three lives could be complete? The bottle of green liquid on the sill, is it real? The bottle on the peeling sill, is it filled with green, or is the liquid an illusion of fullness? How summer's children turn into fish and rain softens men. How the elements of summer nights bid us to get down with each other on the unplaned floor. And this feels painfully beautiful, whether or not it will change the world one drop. Key episodes from an earthly life. As surely as there are crumbs on the lips of the blind, I came for a reason. I remember when the fields were no taller than a pencil. Do you remember that? I told him, I've got socks older than her, but he would not listen. You will starve out, girl, they told her, but she did not listen. As surely as there is rice in the cuffs of the priest, sex is a factor, not a fact. Everything I do is leaning toward what we came for. Is that perfectly clear? I like your shoes, your uncut hair. I like your use of space, too. I wanted to knock her lights out. The air cut in and did us some good. One thing about my television said it has a knob on it, enabling me to switch channels. Now it is your turn to shake or provoke or heal me. I won't say it again. Do you like your beets well cooked and chilled, even if they make your gums itch? Those dark Arkansas roads, that is the sound I am after, the quiring of crickets. Around this time of year, especially evening, I love everything. I sold enough eggs to buy a new dress. I watched him drink the juice of our beets and render the light liquid. I came to talk you into physical splendor. I do not wish to speak to your machine. Girlfriend poem number 4. Together, they will marry the man who will not wear gloves. In the morning, they throw hair from their brush out the window. Now the birds have enough for a nest. A lot is moving in the frangible life of the soil. Amid the susurrus of grasses, one chair waits near another. The public is in ecstasy. Girlfriend poem number 5. The brunette is boarding a train with many bundles. The pockets are sewn shut on her rayon jacket. The old world tapers away. The day slips through the straw, whole as an egg. We use Greg shorthand so the men won't understand. The brunette has traveled over 700 verst. A breath parts her lips. Let's nurse one another's babies, she says, even before we tell what we've been reading. Flame. The breath, the trees, the bridge, the road, the rain, the sheen, the breath, the line, the skin, the vineyard, the fences, the leg, the water, the breath, the shift, the hair, the wheels, the shoulder, the breath, the lane, the streak, the lining, the hour, the reasons, the name, the distance, the breath, the scent, the dogs, the blear, the lungs, the breath, the glove, the signal, the turn, the need, the steps, the lights, the door, the mouth, the tongue, the eyes, the burn, the burned, the burning. Spring Street Girlfriend, number 8. In the snug harbors, helicopter and electric eel blink like string light in the pathetic, exhaust-resistant trees. There has to be one more night like this, and then peace and prosperity will reign for an even minute. The vendor's hands don't look very clean, but we knew it was a dirty city. The chestnuts smell deceptively good. We're hungry, even though they are mealy. And then she comes down in her Otis elevator holding a cricket cage. She purposely wears the purple terry cloth robe of nobility. The music scarcely changes up until now, and then with the tiniest monogram scissors, we snip a ribbon of undergraduate hair. She offers the food of her breast. She does not give a fig about our depression glass. She's not into collectibles. She does not rust or crack. Up to this point, we know no more than two of the names under which she wrote, nor her intellectual milieu. The Buddha in the takeout emanates an unknown strain of mercy, and then we get suddenly scared and tell the driver we want transfers to the real world where the fish smell like fish and the cheese like cheese. I'll read a couple of short passages from One Big Self, Prisoners of Louisiana. Just a taste of it, I guess. Count your fingers, count your toes, count your nose holes, count your blessings, count your stars, lucky or not. Count your loose change, count the miles to the state line, count cars at the crossing, count the ticks you pulled off the dog. Count your shells, count the points on the antlers, count the new jack's keys, count the beds you've got to let, count your cards, cut them again, my dear conflicted reader. If you will grant me that most of us have an equivocal nature and that when we waken, we have not made up our minds which direction we're headed, so that you might see a man driving to work in a perfume and dye-free shirt and a woman with an overdone tan hold up an orange flag in one hand, a Virginia Slim in the other, as if this were their predestination. Grant me that both of them were likely contemplating a different scheme of things. Where do you want to spend eternity? The church marquee demands on the way to my boy's school, smoking or non-smoking. I admit I had not thought of where or which direction in exactly those terms. The radio ministry says G-O-D has a wrong answer button, and we're all waiting for it to go off. Count your gray hairs, count your chigger bites, count your pills, count the times the phone rings, count your T-cells, count your mosquito bites, count the days since your last menses, count the storm candles, count your stitches, count broken bones, count the flies you killed before noon. My dear affluent reader, welcome to the Pecan Land Mall. Sadly, the pecan grove had to be dozed to build it. Home Depot raised another grove. There is just the one grove left, and the creeper and the ivy have blunted its sun. The uglification of your landscape is all but concluded. We are driving around the shorn suburb of your intelligence, the photographer and her factotum. Later, we'll walk in the shadows of South Grand. They say in the heyday of natural gas, there were houses with hinges of gold. They say so. We are gaining on the cancerous alley of our death, which when all is said or unsaid, done or left undone, shriven or unforgiven, this business of dying is our most commonly held goal. Ready or not, zero exceptions, don't ask. Dear prisoner, I too love faces, hands, the circumference of the oaks. I confess to nothing you could use in a court of law. I found that sickly sweet ambrosia of hope, unmendable sane of sadness, experience taken away from you. I would open the mystery of your birth to you. I know we can change, knowing full well, knowing it is not enough. Poetry, time, space, death. I thought I could write an exculpatory note. I cannot. Yes, it is bitter, every bit of it bitter. The course taken by blood, all thinking deceives us. Lead kindly, light, notwithstanding this grave, your garden, this cell, your dwelling, who is unaccountably free. Girlfriend poem number 6. When I snap my fingers, you will wake in a dear yet unfamiliar place. You will scarcely remember your travail. You will be eating green caterpillars over a small fire. An awesome congeries of youthful men and women will be brushing these very tracks away. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Next up is the conversation.
Yeah, that was wonderful. I especially like the mix of old and new work.
Thank you.
And it's great to be able to get a greatest hits album at a point where there are going to be so many more hits, as it were, in the near future.
No, that's it. I'm through.
Yeah, that's not true. I thought I would start by asking you about the way that so many of your poems connect to or trope or describe other art forms. Film, photography, jazz in earlier work. Do you want to talk about one of the other art forms that interest you and the way that your poems respond to it?
Well, with respect to all the other art forms, I am the audience. And I'm a pretty good audience for other art forms. So, in recent years, because I work so much with the photographer Deborah Lester, and our collaboration has been a very compatible one, I've been looking a lot more photographs than I have doing anything else with respect to another art form. I still don't know borscht about photography, but I like to look.
Yeah. How did you first encounter Deborah Lester? Can you talk about some of the projects that you've undertaken with her?
I met her when I was in my early 20s, and so we've known each other quite a long time, and first project we did together was called the Lost Roads Project, a walk-in book of Arkansas. And I had a fellowship that allowed me to commission a number of artists in other media to create this walk-in book of Arkansas. My dream job was to work for the WPA, but I wasn't eligible since it was over with before I came of age. So when I had an opportunity to do a project that had a stipend with it to work with other people, I did my little ensemble mini WPA project that celebrated Arkansas Letters, and it included a reader's map of Arkansas and large format photographs and broadsides of post-World War II writers and videotapes that Forrest Gander did of Arkansans reciting poems that they learned, which was one of my favorite parts of it. Like two kids from Nail, Arkansas, standing in front of a concrete block, a cafeteria wall that was painted to look like a classical Greek landscape, wearing bed sheets and juggling oranges and reciting Ovid in these great country accents. It was just to die for, you know.
Yeah. So. The WPA, the Works Projects Administration, was a 1930s, a New Deal era federal program that found artists and writers and put them to work documenting, showing the real America, as I guess we would say now. Do you want to talk about documentariness or reportage in some of your more recent projects?
I think because that project set other things in motion subsequently, I've become increasingly attracted to some form of the document, not wanting to sacrifice art in order to accomplish that, and feeling like I didn't have to. And Debbie is down with that as well. So that's another reason why it works well for us together, that she feels that she can have a very creative life and still create documents, or that part of our project is for the record.
Yeah, especially with One Big Self.
Especially with One Big Self.
Do you want to talk about the process of making One Big Self, maybe about what that project is?
The photographer got permission to work in three prisons, to photograph in three prisons in Louisiana with permission of the inmates. They signed waivers and they were given prints of every image she took of them. And she asked, after she had been to Angola, which is a maximum security male prison, she asked if I would come down. And I thought, ooh, prison poetry, it's the worst. You know? But, you know, she kept saying, look, this place is, you know, this is the most interesting place I've ever been. And indeed, it is the most interesting place I've ever been either. And so after I went, I definitely wanted to make some kind of effort to create a text for it. I didn't know what to call it. I didn't think I would be writing in line, but sometimes, in fact, I did. You know, for me, for my part of it, was reading and watching videos and films and lots of prison literature, conversations with the inmates, some correspondence with the inmates. But for Debbie, it was all just, right there under her, under the hood of her camera with her, you know, dirty velvet black drop that she would, you know, tape up in an outdoor space at the prisons. She wanted it very, very immediate. She didn't want to research it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the result, if you haven't seen it, it's worth looking for, because you get the prose and verse poetry connected to these photographs, and you also get all of these photographs of inmates appearing as they would wish to be seen.
Yes, that was an important part of it. Yeah.
Is Rising, Falling, Hovering a document or a documentary poem? Can you talk more about that work in progress?
It may be finished. I mean, I published it at Chicago Review, and It took me so long to write that. It took me a couple of years to write that. It's about 30 pages. And I really was afraid that I had killed it. I'd worked on it so hard. But I actually think I didn't kill it. And part of it is, certainly has, you know, has part of, is part of the historical record, you know, of my time, my life, as I experience the war from here.
Yeah. You have written And I quote, "Ruins are beautiful to us. Blues make us feel good. It is through the wound that we perceive the body alive, oh." And as I reread that passage, I thought about the ways in which some of your forms include ruins or wounds or gaps, or I guess blue notes, maybe. I'm thinking of the midline breaks and the center justified poems in Tremble, and of the way that you use short prose fragments put together with gaps in between. Do you want to talk about your sense of form? Is it a sense that includes wounds and bodies?
My sense of form, it took a long time before I was aware enough of form. And once I became very aware of it, I became intensely aware of it. And since I taught a course on the long poem a number of times, I became increasingly interested in extended works, which require a certain amount of, you know, struts. I mean, you have to come up with interesting kinds of formal strategies in order to sustain something. And then that became a very much a part of the pleasure of working on a long work. All of the formal things that I've done have been essentially nonce forms, or forms that I created for the particular project, although some of them are also very much in the tradition, like there are letters in the prison book, which are, you know, so the epistolary tradition is long established, of course.
Yeah. Another form that you have adapted for, I guess it's not a book-length poem, I don't know that it's appeared as a book, but for a continuing series of poems, is the form of the retablo. Do you want to talk about how one makes, what a retablo is for those who don't know, and how they become poems by C.D. Wright?
Well, you know, I still get retablo and ex voto confused. But I think retablo is a tribute and a thank you for it being, for some intervention. And it could be, you know, from appendicitis, or it could be from having been robbed, or at any rate there is a rescue.
And it is specifically a Mexican folk art tradition, right?
Right, on metal. And again, this was a project with Deborah Lester, who, she only did 10 or 11 of these, and she asked, and they were on large sheets of metal, and she painted on the image, and she asked me to write poems for them, which I did, and then I got someone to translate them into Spanish so they could be bilingual. But they were just, I mean, they were a tribute to that form, to the folk art form, and they're not, you know, really retablos, but they're a tribute to them.
They're like retablos. They trope them.
Yeah.
It's easy to see and to hear the language and the places and people of Arkansas in many of your poems. Where should we look, or should we look, for Rhode Island?
I think one's from Arkansas, always from Arkansas. So I don't, you know, and Arkansas is probably less evident in the poetry than it used to be, though, you know, once again, I've sort of been working on something there. I think it just has to do with a place that was very distinct at one time. The part of the state I'm from is not so distinct anymore. It could be anywhere now. It's, you know, quite homogenized. But I think it's just where you spend your formative years. Mm-hmm. And the Arkansas Ozarks, as I was growing up, they really were, you know, wild and woolly and distinct. And so they made a lasting impression on me. Rhode Island's quite lovely, but it doesn't have the same impact on me.
That makes
Mexico
sense.
Has an impact on me. That may be the only other place by which I feel so impacted that I have to somehow articulate it.
Makes sense. One of the advantages of this format is that if I think there's a poem that everyone out there should hear a little bit of, at least, and you didn't read it, I can read a bit of it and then ask you about it.
Okay, read at me.
Uh-huh. Can I read this one?
Personals, yes.
Yeah, yeah, this is a poem of CDs that begins, "Some nights I sleep with my dress on. My teeth are small and even. I don't get headaches. Since 1971 or before, I have hunted a bench where I could eat my pimento cheese in peace." And the poem goes on like that, and as one moves through it, it becomes clear that it is, in some sense, a personal ad for the inner self, in search of a reader who is a soulmate. I wondered whether all poems are like personal ads, are notices for a self that is always seeking companions.
I think that's probably true. That's like Emily Dickinson's "This Is My Love Letter to the World."
Mm-hmm.
Does
she say love letter?
Yes. Doesn't she?
I think she just says, "This is my letter to the world."
All right. So.
I'm sorry. It feels like a love letter.
It does feel like a love letter. And I think writing is a love letter, even if it's cantankerous writing.
Yeah.
Testing, you know.
Yeah. Well, yours is. which makes it better. We're talking about the epistolary as a kind of poetic form. Do you want to talk about other inherited kinds of poems, about the ode, for example?
No.
I'm sorry. No odes today. It's an ode-free day. Let's switch gears. What music are you listening to right now, recently?
We just got a new Vic Chestnut album, which is wonderful. And something else we've been listening to lately that's really wonderful. I can't think of what it is, though.
It's okay. What were you listening to when you were writing Deep Step?
A lot of down-home blues.
Mm-hmm.
And that came out of a road trip, and the photographer's husband was a folklorist, and he put together a huge, and he runs two radio show programs, and he put together a huge box of CDs for us that he thought were appropriate to the parts of the country we were driving in. But a lot of it was down-home blues.
Mm-hmm. And one can hear that in that poem. Deep Step Come Shining is a poem of a car trip with, can I say King Lear overtones?
Yes.
King Lear overtones through the rural Southeast. There's a poem in Tremble called "Like Someone Driving to Texas by Herself." And there's another poem called "Humidity," in which you write, "They are driving around another beltway of light." And I was thinking just recently about how many car trips and road trips there are in your work. People are driving away, driving to Memphis, driving to Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Is a poem like a car trip? Is a CD write poem like a road trip?
Well, I'd like to think so. I mean, certainly the vehicle for Deep Step Come Shining, which is a book-length poem, was the car, was the road trip. And I felt like I was writing a very all-American poem because it was a car trip. And because I work with the photographer, we're often driving and doing some of our talking and listening to music while we're driving. So I remember I'm listening to a lot of music out of Memphis now because I'm working over in that Delta area.
Mm-hmm.
There's a wonderful avant-garde musician named Tav Falco.
Oh, I've been Tav Falco.
Do you know? I'm sure you know Tav Falco, yeah.
He's an
encyclopedia of the most obscure music. Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No. Does Big Star enter into this?
Big Star's, yes, very much so, yeah.
I sometimes think of number one record, especially when I'm rereading Tremble, the first Big Star record.
Oh, uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Because it's a lyric work. You've described it that way. Can I ask what you were listening to then when you were writing Tremble? Or is that...
I don't remember.
That's fine. That is fine. There are so... The problem with coming up with questions to ask about this work is that it is so various, and so much of it is so powerful that it's always leading me in random directions. There was one more poem that you didn't read that I want to bring up and ask you about.
Okay.
And ask you if there's a secret story or if the whole story is in the poem, which is a poem called Autographs, where the basis of the poem, of the lines of the poem, are the senior superlatives in a high school yearbook. And some of the poem's most wonderful lines are perhaps inappropriate to be read
That's
live on television.
That poem, because it's so dirty.
Well, yeah. However, I can read you four of my favorite PG-13 rated lines from near the end of the poem. I recommend to you the poem called Autographs, and then I'm going to ask you to talk about where it came from. Saving grace, clear out of own accord. Goal, revanchism. Plans for the future, to be a great success socially and in some artistic calling. Third wish, that his fingers remain agile.
What do you want to ask me?
Is there anything about that poem that your readers may not know that you would want them to know, that you would want us to know?
Well, that is a poem sort of like Personals that does take a sort of, formal hit off of what it is, which is signings, all those banal signings in high school annuals. And so it was fun. I was learning to do things formally, like such as that, as I was with Personals. And I was learning that I enjoyed it, just that there was a lot of fun in writing that poem. I didn't think it was the kind of thing that bore repeating, that I, you know, once I'd, like high school, doesn't bear repeating.
Once enough. You do teach.
I do.
You teach older and more experienced, one hopes, students. Do you want to talk about whether teaching has affected your writing or what you've learned from your students?
Well, it depends, on the class, that you have. But I've had some wonderful students, and they're very stimulating. If I were an insurance adjuster, I can imagine getting quite weary of the language that I hear all the time or that I have to speak in. And to be able to talk about books, to be able to talk about poems, to be able to be in a protected environment in which that's a respected inquiry, that's quite a privilege, you know. So, and my students are generally very good, and they also can bring the new word, to me. And, my compulsion to keep up has passed. So... They are my filters, they can selectively bring things forward.
Students as filters.
And they also, of course, over time you become friends with some of your students because you stay in touch and the distance between you, student and faculty disappears over time.
I'm just coming to the point in my own life where I have students who've grown up and published things and are out there.
You do not.
I do. I can give you the citations.
Students are 10,
They're not 10. They're not 10. I have to change the subject again now. And I'm going to change the subject by reading to you again from work that CD could have read to you but didn't. What It Is. Can I read that one?
Sure.
A rhomboid, brilliant, impenetrable, which occurs in a pure state, as dense at the edge as at the center. A widely distributed non-radioactive element, therefore not to be confused with uranium. What is brought about by some of the most lustrous, least attractive wordsmiths? What cannot be fashioned into prose? Let that go is a very hard and a very cold definition. Is that simply a definition of poetry?
That's as close as I could get.
Okay. Okay, and it works. It leads into my next question, which is Randall Jarrell, who is a writer I like a lot, who I think you like too, mm-hmm. once described two poets in the 50s as the best American writers who are married to each other. And it seems to me that you and Forrest Gander fit that rubric now. And when I see that definition of poetry, I think about some of Forrest's work, which uses geology and crystallography and particle physics and cosmology so often. Do you want to talk about other ways in which your writing and his writing interact?
Well, of course, because we have this thing in common, it's a constant in our lives, and it is an unending conversation. We're good readers of each other's work, and once in a while we might fight over a word. No, that's mine. No, that's mine. No, that's, nothing serious, really,
Where you'll encounter a word in life, and the question is who gets to use it in a podcast?
Right. You jump on that word,
Can you remember what was such a word?
Oh, I don't know now,
okay.
But it still happens, of course. We also, Forrest reads everything, and I read, what he presses on me. I mean, I read what I'm reading, what I'm already reading, but then he's also, just an incredibly avaricious reader, and so we have that conversation, too, That's been very nice. I think there are a lot of writer couples, and there are a lot of couples who do the same thing in other, fields as well. And I think that it works, for them, or they wouldn't be able to do it, And so it
works for you.
Yeah.
One more question. No one a means, everyone an end. Mm. That's an ethical command, and it's a goal.
Yes.
How can poets and poetry stay true to that?
Well, how can they not? It does seem like part of the responsibility of anything you do to treat anyone and everyone as a whole person. And to treat the writing as being, part of your individuality. That's what you're trying to bring to, that's what you have to offer is your individuality. I hope it doesn't sound too preachy.
No.
It is, I think any kind of ethos is very important to any kind of artistic undertaking.
And the title One Big Self points to that as well.
Yes, Debbie just snarked that out of the movie by Terrence Malick. It wasn't even in the book it was based on.
Which movie?
He only has done four. The Thin Red Line.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I see three red donuts there. Does that mean our time is up?
It's up.
Okay.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwige Dantica, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.